Thanks very much.
Thank you very much, Chris. And over to Murray Close now.
Great. Thanks very much. First of all, I just want to pick up, I guess, and give an example of land use change, and I guess make the point that if you're really trying to get some land use change, you've got to have some monitoring wells that are basically very close to the land surface, but also shallow wells that are going to basically be seeing what the impact of the land use was immediately up gradient. And I've got an example of land use change where it's basically been determined by monitoring wells that were specifically placed there to detect that change. It looks at the Islington Freezing Works in Christchurch, and they basically used flood irrigation of their effluent for greater than 100 years and just recently stopped this in 1988. It was a high volume of effluent that was applied with high levels of COD, which is chemical oxygen demand, and nitrogen. And the wells immediately down gradient had elevated levels of nitrate up to 33 parts per million, so that's three times higher than the drinking water standard, and medians of between 12 and 14. The upgradient wells had nitrate concentrations much less, a bit of variability, but they had a median of 3.7 milligrams per litre. So there was a large impact, you know, a difference of 10 parts per million due to the effluent application. And this shows the map, and I'll just quickly draw a... This arrow shows the upgradient well, and then these arrows here, these wells here rather, show the downgradient wells. And you can see very close to the source of the contamination, the black areas are where we're applying effluent. And so the shallow wells screen close to the water table, and so you can pick up the effect of land use in this situation. Unfortunately, after they ceased the irrigation, they stopped monitoring these wells, and we've only got further information from a well down here, which is 3 kilometres further down gradient. And these are the nitrate levels from that well 3 kilometres further down. Unfortunately, again, the monitoring only started once the effluent irrigation ceased. But we've got these levels around about 8 to 12 for a period of time, and then they decrease over a period of 2 to 3 years to around 6 parts per million. And so in summary, we can say that at this particular site, the disposal of effluent was having a significant effect on groundwater quality immediately down gradient of the system. And the stopping of that disposal also had an impact. The monitoring well was 3 kilometres further down gradient, and therefore the impact was smaller. And there was also, you can see, a lag of about 7 years before the impact could be seen on the groundwater. Moving now to the main topic I want to talk about, that of irrigation and or different types of irrigation and dairying and the impact that that has on the microbial quality of groundwater. There's been a large increase in dairying combined with irrigation over the last 10 to 15 years in New Zealand. And we really need to know whether that land use, the dairying with irrigation, is having an impact on microbial groundwater quality. I've carried out a couple of studies over the last 10 years, and first one looking at border strip or flood irrigation and dairying, and that was published recently in Journal of Water and Health. And the second study looking at two different spray irrigation systems, a centre pivot and a travelling irrigator, and that was published earlier this year in Journal of Environmental Quality. This is what border strip irrigation looks like. It's a flooding system. The water comes in through the head race and then floods onto the paddock in basically a contoured borders. The important point with regards to the bacteria is that they're particles, and therefore, referring back to what Jenny was saying in terms of the water basically squeezing between spaces, they'll often get filtered out as they move through either the unsaturated zone or the groundwater. However, when you've got a flooded system and you've got some cracks or macropores in the soil and unsaturated zone, the bacterial particles will go rapidly through the soil due to this flooded environment. I carried out a study in Waikaki catchment in South Canterbury. We sampled shallow wells there and measured them for E. coli, which is an indicator bacteria, indicates fecal contamination, and Campylobacter, which is a pathogen, causes stomach diseases. We selected our wells to exclude other sources such as septic tanks and wellhead protection issues, and we found E. coli in 75% of the samples and Campylobacter in 12% of the samples. So it was quite contaminated water. It was shallow water, generally, in this case, less than 15 metres depth. And we found there was more contamination of the shallow groundwater during the irrigation season. What I then did was carry out an assessment of the health risk of drinking that sort of water, because a number of the farmers at the start of the study were actually drinking that water. And so I combined the concentrations found in the groundwater with dose response curves for Campylobacter and the amount that people typically drink, and found a probability of infection during the irrigation season of 60 to 75%. Now, sickness is probably a much smaller proportion, 30 to 50% of the infection rate. So the probability of being sick was about 20 to 35%. And the third part of that study was to look at, okay, are people actually getting sick? And so we looked at the EpiServe notifications of enteric disease in similar areas, dairying with flood irrigation, and looked over a 9-year data period. And the results indicated there were significantly higher levels of these diseases in areas with flood irrigation and dairying compared to areas of dairying with spray irrigation only or the rest of Canterbury. Okay, moving on to one of the spray irrigation systems. The centre pivot applies water every 3 to 4 days with about 10 to 18 millimetres per application, which means you can put water on frequently as the pasture needs it and doesn't tend to flood or cause a lot of saturation of the surface. We did the study at the Lincoln University Dairy Farm. The groundwater is 8 to 10 metres below ground level, and we had both up-gradient and down-gradient wells that were monitored over the water table so that they were getting immediate impact of that land use. And we monitored those wells monthly for 6 years. Once again, we analysed the fecal coliforms, the indicator bacteria, and also Campylobacter. Here's a photograph of the Lincoln Dairy Farm, and you can see in the centre there a cluster of wells that are screened at different depths to make sure that we were always able to sample the water table. And in the background is the centre pivot itself. The results here for the fecal coliforms, we actually had more fecal coliforms in the up-gradient wells compared to the down-gradient wells. And for Campylobacter, the same level, pretty low detections, 0.7% of the samples in both the up-gradient and down-gradient wells. And so there was no difference between up-gradient and down-gradient detections of microbes, and little, if any, impact on microbial quality of groundwater from a centre pivot irrigation system with groundwater at 9 metres and a good management system. The other system we looked at was a travelling irrigator, and our example was a Briggs Rotorainer. Once again, it was a working dairy farm, and the Rotorainer applies water every 14 days with 50 to 60 millimetres per application. And we collected leachate samples from 1.5 metres depth over a 4-year period. This is a schematic of the system we used for collection. We had the dairy farm on the top, the leachate from the urine and dung coming down and being collected at a depth of 1.5 metres from this large lithometer, which was an area of about 12 square metres. We had nine sampling events for rainfall, and the rainfall mean application or mean depth of rainfall for those events was 28 millimetres. Only a very few coliforms and no Campylobacter. With our normal irrigation, we had seven sampling events for those. Some coliforms, a few more. Once again, no Campylobacter. And then on one of those occasions, we had a heavy rainfall at the same time as we had irrigation. And we found a lot more coliforms. So we actually repeated that situation of irrigation, and we increased it to 80 millimetres to simulate irrigation plus heavy rainfall. And in the other three occasions, so a total of four, we had lots of coliforms leaching through, but still no Campylobacter. We realised there were no fresh cowpats. Campylobacter actually survives very poorly, and so we looked at one further experiment to see if having fresh cowpats would in fact cause some leaching of Campylobacter. We placed fresh cowpats on half the life limit of cells. We also spiked it with a trace of bacteria. We irrigated it with the 80 millimetres, which corresponds to the heavy rainfall at the same time as irrigation. And we did get some Campylobacter, fairly low levels, at 1.5 metres. So we did get some transport of microbes if irrigation is combined with heavy rainfall and the cowpats are fresh. But in conclusion, for most of the time with normal amounts of irrigation, 55 millimetres, there was very little of very little leaching of bacteria. There was some detection of Campylobacter if we had the scenario of the irrigation plus the heavy rainfall with the fresh cowpats. There was little, if any, impact of centre pivot system on microbial groundwater quality. But in contrast to that, the border strip or the flood irrigation leached significant levels of E. coli and Campylobacter to shallow groundwater. We demonstrated there was a significant risk of drinking this water and that there was a significant increase in disease notifications for this land use practice. And the recommendation is that border strip areas convert to spray irrigation. Now, this is often happening from a water efficiency and a cost point of view. I guess we hope that the additional impact on the microbial quality of groundwater will help this conversion. So thanks very much.
Thank you, Murray. And our last speaker now, Graham Fenwick.
Good morning. Thank you very much. So we've had some really interesting presentations, really starting out with a discussion about the nature of groundwater and its flows, some detail on the chemistry of water, and then then Murray has talked quite a lot about groundwater contamination and its human impact. What I want to do is to talk about groundwater as a living resource and to think about groundwater or think about the consequences of deteriorating groundwater quality, both from a biodiversity sense and particularly in the latter part of my talk to talk about the consequences of poor groundwater quality for the ecology of groundwaters and how that might impact groundwater quality and groundwater availability itself. So groundwater, back in the 1880s in New Zealand, one of our pioneering scientists discovered that there were animals. These are invertebrates, crustaceans, and mollusks, insects and flatworms and things living in the groundwater, and they spend their entire lives living in the groundwater. This was Charles Chilton, and he was based just at Christchurch and discovered these animals from the family farm at the drinking well, the water well in the backyard. And subsequently we've discovered that there are in fact quite a diversity of these sorts of organisms inhabiting all groundwaters from fractured rock aquifers through to alluvial systems throughout the whole of New Zealand, ranging from near sea level up into mountainous regions. And they're not only confined to New Zealand, they occur worldwide. So we have this quite remarkable diversity of organisms. And the biodiversity in groundwater ranges, of course, from the bacteria and viruses right through to these larger organisms. So some of these animals get up to 20 or so millimetres long. We have others that get up to maybe 6 centimetres long, a big white flatworm. And some of these animals are very powerful swimmers. Others can't swim at all. They simply walk or crawl across the substrate, squeeze through the interstices that comprise in which the groundwater flows. And all of these organisms are potentially affected by groundwater contamination. And we have to ask ourselves then, what are the consequences of that contamination on the organisms themselves? We know that groundwater organisms are likely to occur, well, they occur throughout New Zealand in all sorts of groundwaters and probably to all depths in our groundwater systems. So in Canterbury, for example, our major alluvial aquifers extend several hundred metres deep, and it's quite likely that these animals extend well down into the lower reaches of those depths. Many of these organisms, all of them in New Zealand, are endemic to New Zealand, and some of them are endemic to quite small areas. So they're what we would call short-range endemic species. So we have the potential severe contamination in a localised area to perhaps wipe out the entire population of one or more of these species. Some of these, the current thinking on these groundwater organisms is that they are somewhat more sensitive than river or stream insects and animals to water pollution. So they may be more sensitive to water pollution. They tend to be longer lived as well. So they may be more vulnerable to groundwater contamination. When you've seen these animals on the screen, one thing's quite notable is that most of them lack any body pigments. Or where they do have pigments is primarily in their gut, and it's really the gut contents that are coloured. Most of them lack eyes, and this, along with the lack of body pigment, are characteristics of animals that spend their entire lives in the dark in the absence of light. Also, you can see with this particular slide, these animals are very elongated. Again, another characteristic of groundwater organisms. An adaptation to living in the spine interstices and squeezing their way between these. So the biodiversity within New Zealand's groundwaters is quite substantial. At the moment, we're way behind because this really is one of the last frontiers from a biological sense in the world. We know more about the ocean deeps than we do about the groundwaters beneath Canterbury Plains, for example. So in New Zealand, we've currently got around about 100 named species. And in our collections here in Niwa and with some of our colleagues, we've got another 90 or 100 species waiting to be named. And we know that there are large areas that we've not collected. And there are some groups that we've not looked at very closely at all also. So we expect that there's going to be more than 500 species of organisms living in New Zealand's groundwaters. And as I've said, they occur throughout New Zealand. So these organisms are a bit of a biological curiosity in a sense, but they are valuable components of New Zealand's overall biodiversity. So they're part of our heritage. They contribute to the functioning of New Zealand's ecosystems. But are they more than curiosities? Do they play a real role in helping to maintain water quality, for example? Well, we know that in Christchurch, Jennifer started mentioning it. I think Chris also mentioned it, that in Christchurch, we have very high natural water quality in our household supply, and that is groundwater that comes directly out of the ground. And the Christchurch City Council, in one of its pamphlets a few years ago, noted that our water is purified naturally in underground aquifers. It is not purified chemically. So one of the things that we've been looking at here at NIWA, in association with Murray's group at ESR, is to try and understand that natural purification process. And from our work so far, we've developed this understanding of the groundwater ecosystem food web. So what we find is that unlike on the land surface and in rivers and lakes, where the photosynthesis of green plants and algae provides the fundamental energy sources that drive the ecosystems, in groundwater, where there's no light, we can't have that, but water percolating from the soil surface carries fine particles of organic carbon, organic C, on the slide there. So it comes in dissolved and fine particulate form, along with the bacteria that Murray was mentioning. And that organic carbon becomes bound into film slime layers on the sediment particle surfaces. And those particles might be clay-sized particles, or they might be big cobbles. And those biofilms then are inhabited by bacteria that consume those biofilms, but the biofilms are also consumed by some animals, which also eat some of the bacteria. There are predators present. So through this cycle of living, reproduction, death, there's quite a process going on there, and there are some net losses of organic carbon from the system. So it seems then that the animals, or the groundwater ecosystem, much as in a riverine or lake system, does actually contribute to the natural remediation processes that go on in the groundwater system. We've done a bit of work to try and estimate the extent to which the ecosystem's services do contribute to groundwater bioremediation, but it's extremely difficult to quantify with any reliability. A few years ago, there was a contaminated site where Templeton's wastewater was disposed to land, and beneath that site, we found quite marked concentrations of animals, and did some work there. And our estimates suggested that one of the bigger species that was very abundant, happened to be very abundant there, seemed to consume somewhere around 7 to maybe 28 tons of sediment per hectare per year. So it was essentially cleaning the sediment. It's going around feeding on clay-sized particles, eating these clay-sized particles, digesting the bacteria and the biofilms off those particles, and the species was processing between 7 and about 28 tons of clay-sized particles per year. And that meant that it was removing through its respiration, it was producing around about 120 to maybe 650 kilograms of organic carbon per hectare per year was being assimilated by populations of this one species. And we didn't consider the other species that were present there, but if they were factored into it also, then we could see that the ecosystem was in fact doing quite a significant job in removing this organic carbon contamination of the groundwater itself. So the groundwater ecosystem does seem to have a role in this natural purification process. The graph I've shown at the present time shows the concept or the densities of animals that we found around some ponds, in the groundwater near some sewage disposal ponds at Leeston. And what we see here are some increases in increases in abundance of the animals downstream of the well. So if we look at on this graph here, I'm putting an arrow in here to show where the this is distance from the ponds here. The ponds are where the arrow is. Upstream, we've got moderate densities of animals, and then immediately downstream, we've got large concentrations. And further downstream, we notice that the densities of animals are somewhat reduced, but the colours of the bars indicating the composition of the animals present has changed quite a bit. And we found that's what happened in summer, but here in summer, we've got increases in numbers of copepods and decreases in the numbers of mites or acarina close to the wells, and then increased numbers further away. In autumn, we found a steady increase in numbers of. So here's the well again. The ponds at this point here, and the wells at distances downstream. We find something of an increase in numbers of animals present downstream, but also this marked change in the composition, with increases in annelids, amphipods, acarina, and nematodes closer to the ponds or the source of contamination, and decreases in copepods in the immediate vicinity of the ponds at that time of the year. Here we see that the increase in pollution or decrease in groundwater quality, primarily the increasing abundances or concentrations of organic carbon close to the ponds as a result of the leakage from the ponds was having an effect on the groundwater ecosystem in this way. If we represent that diagrammatically in this next slide, we've got along the bottom of the graph or an increase in organic enrichment from left to right, and then an increase in ecosystem function, and in the previous slide we captured that in the abundance of the animals, an increase in ecosystem function as we go up that axis. What we find is what we refer to as a subsidy stress gradient. So the orange line represents the organic carbon. As organic carbon increases, then we find that the invertebrate biomass, represented by the green line, increases up to a point, and then it begins to decline. And usually that decline coincides with some critical point in dissolved oxygen in groundwater in particular. And that dissolved oxygen tends to decrease quite dramatically as the organic loadings increase. So as the organic carbon increases, the animal abundance increases because of the food subsidy, but at some point that food subsidy becomes too great, stress sets in, perhaps in this instance as a result of reduced dissolved oxygen, and the invertebrate abundances decline.
Hi, Graham, this is Aisha. Just a note that we're running over time, so we'll just need to wrap up fairly quickly for the last few slides, okay?
A very graphic representation of that is sediments taken from a highly polluted well on the left, a clean well on the right. And you can see the marked difference in colour, the fact that the sediment on the right are free draining, and there are fewer animals present in those. So the key thing I wanted to say today then is that Groundwater ecosystem does provide some services that are vital to aquifer sustainability. Groundwater is a living resource. It contains significant biodiversity. It performs ecological services by consuming potentially harmful microbes. It removes organic carbon. The feeding and movement activity tends to enhance aquifer porosity and flow, but we are well aware that there are increasing human threats to groundwater and to this biodiversity, so we must manage the system as a living system. So the life-supporting capacity, the biodiversity of groundwater is fundamental to aquifer yield and to water quality. Thank you.
Thank you very much.